When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 124. I'm your host Will Evans, and tonight I am staying in my beloved Wales and travelling down to Pembrokeshire to talk to founder of the DPJ Foundation, Emma Picton-Jones. Emma, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, really good, thanks.
Good. And are you enjoying some sunshine down there in southwest Wales?
Yeah, it's been nice. It's been nice to have a bit of sunshine and have a lovely evening here, and you can hear the tractors roaring past. So I think the farms are happy anyway.
Yeah, everyone's silaging and cutting grass everywhere, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. It's going like the cafes, because I think it's at the end of the week. So everyone's getting in quick.
So tell us a bit about Pembrokeshire. It is proper farming country down there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. And like, I was lucky enough to kind of grow up on a dairy farm, and so was kind of part of that, you know, from a very young age. And, you know, was kind of, Pembrokeshire is quite different in one sense, where you've got kind of a lot of dairy farms in the area I live in, and then South Pembrokeshire is quite different area again altogether, and the land is even a different colour, and you know, but it's beautiful, and we're really lucky to live here. We're close to the beaches and close enough to kind of jump on the main road to get to Cardiff and Swansea. So yeah, we're in a lucky place down in Pembrokeshire here.
Yeah, and you grew up on a dairy farm, you said?
Yeah. So I grew up on a dairy farm just outside Half-Dress, and we were milking cows up until January 2017, and then you know, Dad decided at that point that the milk prices had dropped and it wasn't kind of worth carrying on, so decided to sell up at that point. And it was a bit of a sad moment, but you know, we've still got the farm, and I can't complain too much. I'm moving back home and gutted the milking parlour out and turning it into a house. So I'm not complaining too much.
Yeah, well, there's a few of us ex-dairy farmers around, isn't there? But you didn't grow into farming after growing up on the farm. You went into primary school teaching instead.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I, although I have a passion for farming, we only had kind of a relatively small farm, I suppose, in comparison to some of the farms around us. And so for me, it was kind of, as much as I'd love to carry on, it was never really an option. And so I decided to go off to college and went up to Carmarthen, then to become a primary school teacher, and sort of did a bit of travelling and stuff in between before coming home then.
Okay, so did you end up teaching in the local area itself?
Yeah, so I ended up teaching in Haverford West, which is literally just down the road. And so, yeah, really fortunate that I kind of went there as a student and did some teaching there, and then they kept me on. They must have liked me for some strange reason, and then I've nearly been there nearly 10 years now, which is bizarre. So no, it's a lovely job to work in, and I'm kind of very fortunate. I'm very fortunate to have a job in Pembrokeshire, to be honest with you. You know, it's tricky to kind of get a teaching job, so no, yeah, it's good.
Yeah. So how did you meet your future husband, Dan?
So we met in Newport Sevens, and if anyone ever has been to Newport Sevens, you'll know it's a bit of a heavy kind of drinking event. And I just gone down there with a couple of friends, and yeah, ended up meeting in the group of lads, and I knew some sort of people that he knew in common. We got chatting, and yeah, and that's where we met. But I think sort of the funniest part of it was me is that it was the middle of silage season, and so, you know, although we met that night, we didn't actually see each other for another 3 or 4 weeks because silage came first, obviously. So he was kind of off doing that instead.
Yeah, because he was a contractor, right? Agricultural contractor.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so he worked for Graham Parks, who was contracting just outside Cardigan, and lived for it, you know, absolutely loved it. He was the man on the butt break and, you know, thoroughly enjoyed his work. But I think, you know, kind of got to the point where he felt like he was a bit of an old man in the young man's game, and couldn't really cope with those long hours.
Yeah.
But yeah, he lived for the silage, you know, he was obsessed with it, as lots of young men are, you know.
Well, definitely. But eventually you went on to have a daughter together and to get married as well.
Yeah. So we had Mally, you know, came as a bit of a surprise, but, you know, it was lovely. And yeah, so Mally came along and then we decided to get married. And it was very much kind of very typical kind of Dan. He was very kind of quiet and unassuming. And he turned around to me and I said, oh, I suppose we should probably get married now. And 2 weeks later, that was it. Registry office, job done. And we bought the rings that night and on the internet. And it was kind of a very, very low-key affair. And then not long after, the Tristan came along. And so sort of seemingly everything kind of was set, I suppose.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good way of doing it to me, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I look back now and I think, oh my God, I remember my mum forcing me to wear a wedding dress. She was like, you can't get married and not wear a wedding dress. And I was having to rock up in my jeans and sandals, you know, I wasn't really care. But yeah, it was nice and quiet and it was what he wanted. You know, he wasn't much of a sociable type of person and hated kind of any fuss and things. So we didn't tell anyone and that caused a bit of a fuss amongst friends because they were like, why didn't you tell us we were getting married? And it's all things that... It was good that it suited us, so.
Yeah, definitely. So tell us about Dan. What kind of a guy was he?
And when I met him, I remember him being, like, very calm. And I remember my kind of initial thoughts of him was, you know, God, you're a really calm, kind of cool person, whereas I was, like, wild and, you know, 100 miles per hour. And, you know, everything was kind of, like, very impulsive. And I decided something and I'd just go and do it. And when I met him, I'd not long come back from Thailand. And I literally decided kind of, in 2 weeks before, I thought, I'm going to go and teach in Thailand. And I went, and my mum and dad were horrified. They were like, oh, what are you doing? And I was kind of this person who would just like make these impulse decisions, where Dan was like, yeah, you know, everything's fine, cool and relaxed and stuff. And I think at that point, what kind of, in hindsight, looking back, he was very good at kind of putting on this, you know, this facade, really, I suppose, as being quite a cool and calm person, when in actual fact, you know, things were quite different, I suppose.
Yeah, because he did struggle with his mental health, didn't he? When did you first realise that?
I think I first sort of started realising it probably when I was pregnant with Mally. And I think, you know, we were quite young and we were, you know, as everyone is when they're expecting their first child, you kind of worry about everything and you're reading stuff and you're kind of thinking, oh, I've got to buy this and buy that. And you've got to buy all this tat that you kind of never used in your entire life. And, you know, all this kind of worry about, oh, this. And there was always this massive concern as well. I was like, Christ, you know, we can barely look after ourselves. You know, how are we going to, you know, look after this baby? And
how old were you both then? How old were you both?
So I was 23, just turning 24. And Dan was, he was 29, just turning 30. And so, you know, neither of us had kind of ever had that massive responsibility. Both of us have been lucky enough to kind of been very well looked after by our parents and grandparents. And so, you know, this kind of idea that we actually had to like have this life was like, oh gosh. And I kind of took it on my stride and sort of thought, actually, you know, this is kind of a new chapter and it's quite exciting and kind of got really excited. But I could see that, you know, the more this kind of went on, the anxious side of Dan started to show. And you could see that he really got quite concerned about things. And rather than kind of being this bit of concern and then it leaving, it would be like this all consuming concern and anxiety about things. And it would really take over. And it kind of really came quite apparent when after Mally was being born, and every kind of little thing would be too much for him, and it would really kind of take over to the point where, you know, he would kind of just get so stressed out about everything and like the smallest things. And I remember kind of saying to Bert, there's no need to worry about it, and it just wouldn't work. And he got to the point where he would kind of not sleep, and he wasn't taking care of himself, and like not looking after kind of the way that he looked, and, you know, he taking care like by showering and things like that. It all kind of went behind the wayside because his mind was so preoccupied all the time. And that was, you know, that was really difficult for him, but it was also really difficult for me because I didn't really understand what was going on at this point.
No. So how did you try to deal with it at the time?
I think my initial kind of reaction was I didn't really want any stress coming on to him, so I just kind of tried to overcompensate as such and trying, you know, almost kind of take any pressure and stress that I could off him to kind of make sure that the kind of anything that was happening, it wasn't gonna get to that point where it stressed him out. So things like financial, you know, the finances and stuff, I took all of that on. You know, any bill that came in, I made sure I sorted it, and so it wasn't any worry for him. And, you know, if I knew that his car needed taxing soon, you know, the truck and stuff, I'd get that sorted. And, you know, when it came to insurances, when he later on he bought a digger and became self-employed with the digger, and I remember I'd sort out the insurances for the digger just to kind of take that pressure off him. And I kind of wanted to do everything I can just to make sure life was quite easy and quite simple for him, because he would get so stressed out about things. And that kind of wasn't probably the right tack to take, because I think at that time, you know, there was very little conversation around mental health at this time. We're talking, you know, six, seven years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, if not more, so yeah, 7 years ago, you know, there was very little conversation around mental health, and people didn't really know, you know, weren't talking about it. It's very hidden. And I remember doing a lot of Googling and kind of like Googling things and like, you know, Googling things of symptoms and whatever. And that was kind of my way of kind of trying to work out what was going on. And I remember kind of putting all this information in, and, you know, about mood swings and stuff. And I went to him one day and I said, look, you know, I think you've got bipolar. And he's like, no, I haven't got bipolar. No, what are you talking about? And looking back now, no, he didn't have bipolar. You know, that's completely wrong. He was actually suffering from depression and anxiety. But, you know, at that time, it was kind of, I didn't want to speak to anyone else about it. And so the easiest way was to kind of turn to the internet for support, because yeah. I felt like if I talked to anyone else, I was kind of doing him a disservice. And, you know, by opening up about what he was going through, I was kind of going behind his back. And I honestly kind of just felt as well that I'd inherited this kind of husband that had grumpy tendencies. And that was kind of, yeah. And you know, I was quite naive, really, I suppose. And I just kind of thought, well, yeah. There we are. You know, this is what marriage is going to be like. And this is what having children does to you. And I've just got to put up with it and kind of kept myself to myself at that point.
Yeah. You mentioned that Dan bought a digger and went out self-employed. Did that help, or did that add to the pressure he was feeling?
I think it kind of went in two ways. I think in one sense, like, that it helps because he kind of had more control over what he was able to do. And so, you know, he really didn't sleep very well at all. He kind of mind be racing, and he'd write lists upon lists every single night, and, you know, rather than sleeping, of things that were going on in his head. And so, you know, if he wasn't feeling great the next day and couldn't really get up and get going, then he could take a few hours off in the morning. But in the same hand, the pressures that came with being self-employed were massive. You know, he worried about people paying bills, and, you know, and he was asked to go in and do this work, and then he'd worry he'd charge too much, and he'd worry he didn't do a good enough job, and if he didn't do a good enough job, then that person would tell the next person. And there's this constant kind of concern. And I remember when he first got the digger, and there was this kind of thing that the digger didn't look good enough, and he literally spent 3 months, you know, without going doing any work at all, just sanding the entire thing down, and he resprayed the entire thing himself, and it looked amazing. But in my mind, back of my head, I'm thinking, you know, we really need to start this thing in him some money. You know, it costs an awful lot of money. But I could never say that, because if I said that to him, it was kind of like I would be putting stress on him. So I always kind of did everything I could to encourage him and kind of make sure that he felt like that he was making a good decision and that kind of thing. And ultimately, you know, looking back, I did a lot of things wrong, really.
We're going to take a short ad break now to talk about agricultural weighing specialist Griffith Elder. Griffith Elder specialise in agriculture with their weighing equipment. They design, manufacture here in the UK and supply weigh bridges, portable weigh beams, multi-axle weigh bridges and a host of other weighing equipment for weighing on the farm. The scales are a great way to know how much you've taken from the field and keep track what you have coming in and going out. The portable weigh beams are incredibly easy to install, so no need for any groundworks, and can be placed straight in the yard or moved from store to store as and when you need. All of their scales come with an extensive range of recording equipment options and farm management software. And one very popular piece of kit is their cab fob system, which enables the driver to record the weight of their load without having to leave the comfort of the cab. Built to last for decades, Griffith Elder pride themselves in making simple to install, easy to operate and proven longevity weighing equipment for all their products.
So in 2015, your son Tristan was born. Did that initially help, you know, the sort of new lift we all get as dads from a new baby being around?
I think kind of that's what I hoped, and I kind of really kind of wished the whole time I was pregnant that it would be kind of like the almost like it would complete the family. You know, every dad wants a son, don't they? And they kind of want that kind of person. You know, he wanted that person to kind of come on the digger with him and have that interest in tractors and things like that. And, you know, I kind of hoped that that was what would be the case. But I think it kind of went really the opposite way. It kind of caused even more stress and worry for him, because it was almost like now we had two human beings that were kind of in charge of, and he worried about things like about the future and about what would happen to them and were they going to be okay. And then, you know, around the time that Tristan was born, Mali started school, and I remember this intense kind of fear about Mali starting school and about how whether she'd make friends and whether she'd be okay, and all this kind of fear around everything. And it kind of really just was a constant. I remember from the point that Tristan was born, it was really just very constant.
Okay. And what about your family? Did they try to help
Did they realise that things weren't right?
I think because I kind of tried to keep it to myself, nobody actually realised the seriousness of what was going on. I think everyone kind of knew that he was a worrier and you know, got a bit anxious about things, and, you know, he very much kind of isolated himself from everybody. So it was almost difficult for them to spot anything because he didn't kind of spend much time, you know, with kind of friends and things like that. And so, you know, it was very difficult for anyone to have a handle on kind of what was going on. And I think really, you know, people naively presume that, you know, he had me. And he had children, so nothing was ever going to happen, you know, because you've got everything you could possibly need. And in actual fact, you know, that's not always the case. He was worried about who would ring him, and he just panicked about what they'd want and things. So it was easy for him to switch it off and ignore the world, basically. And so I got in touch with the counsellor and I said what was going on. And I remember her email reply was basically like, no, I can't do anything to help because I need him to contact me. And I said to her, look, you know, he's in a really bad way and he'll speak to me now and I promise I can get him to you. But he won't speak to anyone in the outside world currently, and we're in a bit of a crisis point here, and he won't speak to his doctor about it. But, you know, I need you to kind of give me a lifeline here. And she wouldn't do it. And so at that point, kind of, I just remember feeling really alone and kind of lost as to kind of where this was going to go, I suppose.
So, that just seems crazy, because there'll be a lot of guys in that situation who just wouldn't make the call themselves, would they?
Yeah, and I think I remember kind of thinking this at the time, you know, like that he was quite open with me, and I remember us talking hours and hours kind of at length very often about what was going on in his head. And, you know, it was kind of like I was at gateway and I wanted to get him that help, but the fact that she wouldn't help me was just kind of like a brick wall to me. And I just remember just getting really frustrated about it and thinking, well, who can I turn to for help? Because, like I said, I didn't want to kind of turn to anybody that was close to us, because I didn't want to feel like I was disrespecting him in any way, or sharing kind of what was going on with other people. And, you know, he's a very private person and I wanted to respect that.
Okay, so what happened then in July 2016?
So in July 2016, it was kind of, I always started to think that really things were kind of starting to go on the up a bit. We'd actually gone on the track to run and he'd been really good on that. And we decided to go for a meet in the pub. And like, this was massive. You know, it sounds like it's just a meet in the pub, but it was just huge. This was the first time that he'd been in the pub that, you know, since we'd lived in the village. And that was years at this point. And, you know, we decided that we were going to go for a meal. And after that, he decided he was going to stay and have a drink. And I was like, great. You know, he's kind of mixing with the locals and he's finally kind of not just being alone all the time. And for me, that was kind of really positive. But unfortunately, kind of this whole sort of idea that people have when they have a few drinks of banter sort of came about. And banter is really good and it's kind of good fun and a good laugh. But when you're really vulnerable, it can kind of have a massive impact on the way you feel about yourself. And unfortunately, that was the case, you know, and there was a lot of banter about going about. And Dan just took it, you know, completely to heart and it kind of really played on his head. And he couldn't really get over that as such. And on the Sunday, I remember him being kind of, you know, very kind of up and down about things and very stressed out about everything and couldn't relax. And I went to work on the Monday and it was very similar. And he texted me saying he couldn't cope. And I just remember thinking, God, you know, things must be really bad if he's telling me that he can't cope. And so when I came home that night, I kind of encouraged him to talk and did that old age thing that we do with British people and kind of say, oh, you know, go and have a nice sleep and you'll feel better. Yeah. And hope that kind of would sort the problem out, when in actual fact it didn't. And he couldn't sleep. So he did what he quite often did and went to go and see his family. And I kind of wholeheartedly encouraged that. As far as I was concerned, you know, the more people he was talking to, the better. But unfortunately, it didn't kind of work out like that. And he did go seek his family. But he called me about 2 o'clock in the morning and said he was going to go and visit another member of his family. And I remember sort of saying to him, oh, just come home, you know, don't be silly. And, you know, if I'm completely honest, my first reaction, the fact he wasn't coming home was, right, there's like another woman involved here somewhere or something. But, you know, my kind of suspicious female radar went clean off at that point. And I remember saying, you know, just come home. And I remember him sort of saying to you, you know, I love you. And I was like, oh, I love you too, just come home, sort of thing. But he didn't. And I woke up in the morning. And he hadn't come back. And I knew that something wasn't right because it was his day to look after the children. And so, you know, you get that kind of feeling. And it was this feeling where my head was telling me, come on, Emma, everything's going to be fine. But my gut was telling me this is bad and this is going to end really bad. So I decided to go look for him and kind of went to the small holding where he grew up. So I went up to him. And unfortunately, as I got there, I was greeted with several police cars. And it sort of so turned out that Dan had taken the decision to hang himself on the tree outside the place that, you know, he'd grown up in and that we'd lived in for a few years. And Mali had spent, you know, the best part of her childhood at that point at that home. And life really kind of went spiraling out of control. And I just remember all of these questions kind of coming through my head and things sort of like, you know, who's going to walk Mali down the aisle and who's going to kind of teach us how to play rugby and all these kind of things, just like ridiculous things that were going through my head. And I just remember just running and just screaming and kind of just not knowing what to do at that point. And life just kind of went completely haywire, and I'd gone from being 27 and married with two children to all of a sudden I was a widow, and my 4-year-old and 16-month-old child had no dad, and that was kind of the reality of the situation straight away, really.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to ask you how you felt, but do you remember much, or is it just a blur those few days?
I think part of it is very clear in the sense that I remember it being very structured, and it had to be like the next morning it was like, right, you've got to go and identify the body. And that afternoon the police came and they brought a letter, and it was very much like, this has got to happen then this happens and this happens and this happens. And in between there was just like an influx of people kind of coming into the house, and nobody could quite believe like what was going on, and I couldn't quite believe what was going on. And I remember kind of that first night going to bed, and it's that whole kind of thing, you know, where you wake up and you're a bit like, oh, where am I? And you're not kind of sure what's going on. And I remember waking up and kind of almost forgot what had happened. And then I thought about it and I remembered what had happened. And I just remember screaming. And my mum was staying with us, and you know, she came in, she's like, you know, what's going on? And I just remember saying, this isn't right. You know, every part of this isn't right. It's not right that the kids don't have a dad. It's not right that he's dead. You know, this should have been something more that could have been done about this. And that's kind of where my kind of passion for having to try and do something about the whole situation really came from. And coupled with the letter, you know, that Dan left, and it was a very lengthy letter with lots of kind of information in it and lots of kind of very statemented pieces. And one part of it said in it, you know, you weren't able to help me, but you could try and help someone else. And so that really stuck with me and kind of spurred me on to try and do something, I suppose.
Yeah. So how old were Mali and Tristan then? Because I guess the worst thing was having to tell them, I suppose.
Yeah, so Mali was 4 at this point, and you know, how do you explain to a 4-year-old that their dad's not coming home? And, you know, dad was everything to her. You know, I was that naggy one that told her off all the time and kind of made her eat vegetables and all those awful things. But, you know, dad was the fun one who took her on Digger, and when he picked her from school, got marshmallows and ice cream and stuff. And, you know, I was kind of like always the Wicked Witch of the East. And so all of a sudden, this light of her life had gone. And that was the most difficult conversation, you know, of my life. But also, you know, one that I remember thinking, this shouldn't be happening. And it was this whole kind of reality of things that this isn't right. And I remember constantly saying to somebody all the time, this is not right. And it was horrific. And Tristan at that point was 16 months old, you know, he's a baby virtually, and running around in nappies, and, you know, had no idea what was happening. But I suppose a part of it, you know, without them, I probably would have come through it very differently. You know, as it stood, Mali had a birthday party on the Saturday after, so I had to take her to the birthday party, and Tristan had places to go to, and, you know, I still had to be mum. I couldn't just give up those duties.
Yeah.
So because I had those duties, it kind of almost probably brought me through that first couple of weeks, I suppose. And, you know, I had to take them to school and pick them up from school, and I had to, you know, face other parents and things like that. And although everyone completely ignored me, I was very adamant the fact that I was still going to be a mum to them. You know, they'd lost their dad and they needed me at that point.
Yeah, unfortunately real life goes on, doesn't it? But I mean how did people react towards you? Were they supportive, or was it a case of people just not knowing what to say to you?
Yeah, it was completely that. People just did not know what to say and what to do. And it was very much this idea of kind of, because it was his decision to end his life, nobody knew how to react to that, because it was like everybody was angry, and a lot of people around me were very angry at the fact that he'd left me and the children in this kind of state. And, you know, it was a lot of anger directed around, but then there was an awful amount of sadness as well. You know, that how can someone feel that low, that kind of awful about things, that they felt that was the only decision? And there was a lot of kind of mixed feelings around, and nobody really knew how to react, and an awful lot of people decided just to ignore me rather than kind of actually come to see me, because they didn't know what to say. And you know, I don't blame them at all, you know, because we were in very different times. You know, it's 3 years ago now on Friday, and you know, that was very different times, and people weren't talking about mental health quite so much, and it was just becoming to sort of start being a conversation. I'd like to think if it happened kind of now, that people would be more responsive and proactive about talking about it, because we are in a better place now than we were a few years ago regarding mental health and how we kind of deal with suicide and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So very quickly, you decided that you wanted to help others. So tell us about the DPJ Foundation. How did you go about setting it up after you had the initial idea?
So, yeah, you know, as I said before, like, everything was very structured kind of in the weeks after Dan died. It was very much kind of, you know, this had to happen then, and then the funeral was happening, and there were certain things I had to do in preparation for the funeral. And I remember the funeral director sort of saying to me, you know, what is it that you want to give the funeral donations to? Like, who do you want to give them to? And I remember kind of really struggling with this, because Dan never accessed any support. I didn't really know where that money should go, and I wasn't very aware of mental health charities at this point, because I never kind of accessed anything or did anything. And so I started kind of looking around for mental health support, charities that supported people in agriculture, and I was quite shocked to learn there was very little in the way of support that was happening, particularly in Wales. And, you know, really good things happening in Australia and New Zealand and stuff. But actually, I wanted the money to go in our community to the people that Dan cared about and things like that. And, you know, there's fantastic national charities that are doing amazing things within our community, but very little of those are actually doing specific support for the farming community. Yeah. And, you know, having grown up in that sector, I knew how different they were and how the support they needed was different. It's not a 9-to-5. They can't fit in that slot, you know, has to be kind of different. And so kind of having a conversation one night with the funeral director and the person who was taking the funeral, and said, you know, I was really struggling with that, and he turned around and he said, oh, well, why didn't you do something about it yourself? And I think at that point it was kind of a glimmer of light that I needed to kind of give me some kind of hope at that point. And I'd gone from 100 miles per hour wild kind of flamboyant person to all of a sudden just being very low and not understanding where my life was going to be, from let alone the next day or the next week or the next month, but it was the next hour I couldn't see at that point. And so, you know, for that kind of glimmer of hope, it was kind of good for me. And I remember saying, right, well, I'm going to do this, you know, I'm going to set up a charity that supports people in agriculture. And little did I know, 3 years on, I'd still be doing it. I quite honestly thought that what we would do is use the money from the funeral donations and kind of do something positive in the community. And kind of then that was it. And I'd learn how to kind of live as a widow and kind of look after my kids and kind of go forward like that, when in actual fact, I think the need for it was obviously quite apparent, because, you know, very quickly money started snowballing in, and people kind of heard about what had happened and wanted to donate money. And, you know, all of a sudden gone from £8,000 in funeral donations to £25,000 because people had been fundraising. And, you know, I had all these questions like, oh, what are you going to do with the money? And I was like, oh my God, I have no idea. I was like, I'm a primary school teacher. I have no clue about mental health. And I was very, very conscious of this fact that I have no qualifications. And, you know, put me in front of a class of six-year-olds and I'm happy as Larry, you know. But this whole idea of kind of trying to do something to support a really vulnerable group of people scared me. But I think what came quite clear was the fact that actually having lived with somebody with poor mental health problems had probably given me better experience than I could ever have got out of a university course, if I'm completely honest.
Yeah.
And so it kind of went from there, and I did a lot of research and did a lot of kind of Googling again, that lethal thing of Googling. But I spoke to an awful lot of people and kind of found out what was happening and decided kind of how I was going to use that money going forward then.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So tell us about the charity and exactly how it works. What are the main things you do for people that ring you and ask for help?
So there are like three main strands really to what we offer. The first being mental health awareness training. And this basically came about because I saw the good kind of response there was within, you know, worldwide really, to support groups. And it was this idea that people go to a local kind of space where people go and they'll be able to chat about their mental health. But, you know, the practical side of me knew that if I was going to do that in my local community and trying to get farmers in there, you know, if I could get them in the first place, it would be a miracle, because guaranteed someone would be milking, or they'd be lambing, or if something, some disaster had happened in the farm and they couldn't leave, you know, out it goes. And then, so I kind of getting them in the first place with the issue. But, and then I thought, you know, when farming, when they actually got there, it wouldn't be a structure, it wouldn't be good enough conversation. You know, there'd probably be conversations around Brexit, about milk price, and about kind of all these issues that are facing us day to day. But actually the ability to open up personally about what was affecting them and about their feelings and their thoughts and things like that, the conversation wouldn't happen, because as a sector, we're very, very proud about how we are, who we are, and how we cope with things. And breaking down that was kind of too much. And I appreciate that. And I'm kind of very weary of that. And I would never expect somebody to kind of do that in public. It's not for everybody. But I like this idea of having support in the community. So decided to get that idea of support and kind of put it, rather than expect people to come to get it, we'd send it out there. And so the idea was, if we had people who were trained in mental health awareness, so they could spot the signs of someone with poor mental health, and they could go out and be able to signpost them in the right direction, and almost be able to kind of, like, you know, have that conversation and give that person that initial kind of support before they get the professional support. So we have people from the NFU and FUW and Feed Rep, vets, people from DEFRA, you know, people from kind of all over, all agricultural aspects, all over Pembrokeshire came, and we put 75 people through that training. So that's now developed into mental health first aid and further into mental health awareness, which I've been fortunate enough to go all over Wales delivering. And since we started, we've probably trained near enough 500 people across Wales in this. And so that's kind of really, wow, really good for me to be able to say that we've kind of put that support back in the community. And, you know, lots more people are aware of what the signs to look out for and how to support somebody who's suicidal. It's kind of my hope that if somebody came across somebody who was like Dan, they'd be able to kind of have the balls, I suppose, to say to them, look, you know, what's going on? And I can see that something's not right, and I'd be able to help them. And that's kind of one kind of aspect of what we do. And then the second aspect is looking at kind of that practical support for somebody who is struggling. And talking is the single most effective way of dealing with poor mental health. So we've decided to set up a counselling referral service. And this is basically because the counselling and talking therapies waiting lists in Wales are currently kind of anything between 6 to 9 months. So that means that if you go to your GP to look for support, then you're going to be waiting an awful long time to try and get it. Whereas actually farmers are quite an impatient bunch of people, and you know, really kind of need to have that support straight away. And that's even if they get to the GP in the first place to, you know, to kind of ask for that help. And like myself, you know, with my job, I can go through HR and go to kind of my line manager and that kind of thing to get that help. It's a very different route for anyone who's self-employed, yeah, and in particular farmers. So I set up this service called Share the Load. And this basically means that people from the agricultural community, men and women and children and mothers and fathers, and anyone who's directly affected by mental health and feels like they need some support, can call our call line, which is open 24 hours a day. They can text, they can get in touch on Facebook, they can send an email. And basically, unlike that woman who was so unhelpful to me years ago, we will be able to turn around to them and say, yes, we can help you. But not only can we help you, we can help you like straight away. Yeah. And we currently kind of get counsellors to call people back within 24 hours. And then within a week, then they're seen by the counsellor, and they can be seen in a village or a town that's close to them. They can have a counsellor that will go onto the farm, or they can have somebody on the telephone or online as well, if you can get good enough broadband signal, which is the crux of the issue, yeah, right there, as we know.
Let's not mention that.
No. So it's kind of like making it as accessible as possible. And we did it for a pilot year in Pembrokeshire and had 46 farmers come through. Wow. And then we launched this year in Carmarthenshire, Ceredigion and Powys, but we're also covering Monmouthshire, and we've also got people up in North Wales as well. So we're pretty much covering the whole of Wales now, which is really, really exciting. And we kind of spread the word about what we're doing through social media posts, and you know, we put a daily post because we've kind of learned that farmers are amazing photographers, and they have the best photos of cows and tractors and land and, you know, the beautiful countryside of Wales on their phones. And they send us like thousands of photos through that we kind of put positive messages on, and you know, kind of information and support. That's and funny. Things like that on these photos that get shared. And yeah, and try and spread awareness and get people aware of the fact that mental health is okay to talk about. And, you know, people are kind of, you know, let's take note of the fact that this is a real issue in our community, that agriculture carries a high rate of suicide, and let's do something about it as a community. And to be able to spearhead that is brilliant. It's scary because, as I said, you know, this has kind of come from nowhere to me, but it's brilliant that it's kind of having that effect on the community, really.
Yeah, I mean, you've had an unbelievable response to it, haven't you? People have really, really helped with fundraising and really, I think, sort of recognised the need there is in our community for this, haven't they?
Yeah, definitely. I think it shocks me every single day, because every single day I get emails from people who say, "Oh, we're going to do this to raise money for you." Yeah. And I get texts through the post of people who've like never even heard of it, and they're like, "We did this for you and this, that." And, you know, it's amazing. And to kind of have that support from our community, you know, we've got farmers walking like 9 peaks across the whole of the UK in 72 hours, you know, have all of this amazing
shout out to Matt Launder, the ginger farmer there.
I know. Matt Launder did an absolutely stand up. His knees are still not quite
well, recovered. Legend.
But I feel like he's having copious amounts of alcohol currently to get through it. We promised him we do an event in the winter. We do a winter ball, and basically like a big celebration of the year kind of thing. And we've invited them all along.
Brilliant.
And I promised him a crown to be king of the mountain. We don't want to blow any more trumpet up his bum, but now he's doing really well. And what he did for kind of us and for the sector is unbelievable. To have a new kind of young farmer coming through who's kind of talking about mental health so openly is amazing. And I every day I'm shocked and amazed by kind of what happens, and it's great. It's a lovely kind of thing to be part of.
Yeah, definitely. And you've got involved with some of the fundraisers yourself as well, doing runs, jumping out of a plane, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. So I did, done a few different runs. I'm not a runner in any way, shape or form. I literally no shape at all. I can't run. I've had like several operations on my knees. Anytime a running thing comes up, I remember it's not a good idea. I did a bungee jump. That was horrible. It was the worst experience ever. Jumping up the plane now was amazing. Absolutely loved that. That was brilliant. But it's taken me to some weird and wonderful things. And I think the best kind of thing that I get out of it is very much being part of this community spirit and, you know, getting everyone together and to be able to kind of, and when it was the 1 year anniversary of the foundation, we got together and I had this idea that I wanted to do a little bit of a party, and this little bit of a party kind of grew horrendously and ended up with 280 people in a marquee in a field, which just kind of was brilliant. And we had a band and copious amounts of alcohol and puddings everywhere. And it was brilliant. And, you know, to kind of get to that point where you've got that many people around you who are kind of almost part of that family with you is just, it's brilliant. And I spent a lot of time feeling alone, you know, when Dan was alive, mm-hmm. because I didn't know how to cope. And now I'm never alone. I've always got kind of people with me. And if I haven't got them, I've got 7,000 people on Facebook who are kind of following the page avidly and sharing and supporting constantly, which is just unreal, really.
Yeah. Well, yeah. On that then, where can people find out more if they want it? If someone's listening and they're recognising that somebody maybe needs help, where can they go to find out more details?
So we have a website, which is www.thebjfoundation.co.uk. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, we're soon to be on Snapchat as well. And, you know, I'm pretty much sure you can just Google it and everything comes up. Apparently I'm very Googleable.
You are.
Being on Country File does well for that, apparently. So, yeah, and then, but please do. And, you know, the service is there and we've been so well supported. We have the money there to support people in Wales at least for the next 3 years. So use our service, you know, and if you recognise things in yourself or you're feeling kind of low or you recognise signs in other people, you know, get in touch and get help. And it's okay to kind of get that support and, you know, have that kind of help with what's going on.
Definitely.
So before we start to wrap things up, I cannot let you go without asking you about the Pride of Britain Awards. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, that was unbelievable. I felt a little bit conned, if I'm completely honest, because they rang me up and they were like, "Oh, we're making a television programme about people who do good things in the community." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, you know, there's loads of us and we all do this and that and whatever else have you." And then when they started asking me questions like, "Do you watch Coronation Street?" I was like, "Why are you asking me this question?" And I was like, "No." I was like, "I used to watch Emmerdale when they actually did farming." And I said, "But now," I said, "I'm way past that. I don't watch anything." And they were like, "Who's your favourite band?" And I was like, "God," I was like, "I am 30. Why are you asking me what my favourite band is?" I was like, "I haven't been asked that since I was 12. So we've asked like really random questions. And I remember thinking, this is very strange. And then I had a phone call and they said, yeah, that I'd won this Pride of Britain award. And it was unbelievable. And, you know, the experience to be able to go up to London and you know, sitting opposite Davina McCall, who just looks unbelievable in real life. You know, she was there, and I'd go to Downing Street and met Theresa May, and to tell her about the issues that are facing our farmers in Wales and what we're able to do for them is just the most unreal experience of my life. And then, you know, we get there and I'm sat on the table with the Saturdays, and I went away with Wayne Bridges' mobile number. He's like, call me if you ever need anything. I was like, okay. I met Michael Sheen and he was like, here's my email address, I'll do anything I can for you. And I was like, wow. Oh my god, this is unbelievable.
That's really cool.
I remember kind of going to the loo and walking back, and Nick Knowles was there off kind of DIY SOS fame, and he's like, I can't believe what you've managed to do. And it was just surreal. It was absolutely surreal. And I remember waking up the next morning and just thinking, actually, I just want to go home now. this life isn't for me. I was like, London's too big and too busy. I want to get back to my kids. I want to get back to my peace and quiet and things like that. But it was an outstanding experience. And you know, I'm ever, ever so grateful for the fact that they even considered me for that. And I'm still not entirely sure they got the right person. I quite often feel like I kind of got away with that one, and I'm not sure quite how. But yeah, it was an unbelievable experience, really.
Yeah, I'll bet. And it must have been lovely for your family as well.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, my dad came up, and my brother, and my mum came up, and my partner. And, you know, it was really good. And we all kind of came up together. And, you know, my dad was kind of like deer in the headlights. He was like, there's Richard Hammond's behind me. And I was like, you know, and it was all these kind of funny things. And, you know, all of these, you know, gorgeous women. And my brother was just like absolutely flabbergasted to the point where he couldn't even speak. And there was one of the girls from the Saturday sat next to him. And every time she talked to him, he was like, he couldn't even speak. It was like, we properly looked like we were out of our depth. You know, we were kind of definitely the farmers in the room at that point. But it was amazing. And, you know, like I said, to be able to kind of, that program went out to something like 12 million people. And to kind of be able to stand up and say, this is what we're doing for agriculture because there is a problem, was just the best opportunity for getting that message out there. And yeah, it was great. Really good.
Yeah. Yeah, not quite as many listeners to Rock and Roll Farming, unfortunately.
Do you know what, though? It's the right type of people, and that's what's good.
Right then, we will wrap this up with the traditional hard-hitting quick quiz questions. These are even harder than you had on that phone call, I think.
These are really, I'm nervous, if I'm honest.
All right then, what's your all-time favourite song?
So I definitely think it's, I really struggle with this one. I love McFly. I'm a massive McFly fan. But Mumford & Sons to me holds like a real special place in my heart, and there has to be Lover of the Light by Mumford & Sons, definitely.
Okay. If you were banished from Wales, then, and I think this must be...
It could happen.
Where would you choose to live?
Somewhere hot, yeah. But I'm thinking like the Caribbean. I'm hopeful that one day farmers in the Caribbean will need my help, and I can go out there and do some support out there. So yeah, but definitely like the Caribbean on a beach somewhere.
Similar climate to Pembrokeshire, obviously.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right.
Just like Newgale Beach.
And what's the best meal that you can cook?
I don't know. I found this tricky because I'm more of a baker, so I like baking cakes.
Okay.
and kind of making all kinds of weird and wonderful things. But I make a pretty mean roast dinner. And I kind of like, I like loads of flavour and stuff. So yeah, I'm gonna go for a roast dinner for that. Chicken. It's gotta be chicken.
I think that'll be my answer as well. I think I'd go for roast dinner. Yeah. It's about the only meal I can cook. You can have one superpower, just one. What's it gonna be?
The ability to make my children sleep instantly. That is literally all I want in life. I want to be able to click my fingers and the job is done, and it's 12 hours and that's it, we wake up. That's all I want.
Just like Mary Poppins. Yeah, I think there'd be a lot of parents of young children who might sympathise with that one.
Yeah, because all I can hear currently is one of them screaming downstairs.
Okay.
It would be a really handy one right now.
And last but not least then, what is your favourite farming related social media account to follow?
I would say Abby Reader. I think Abby is a fantastic advocate for women in farming, but not just that, just farming in general. You know, what she's kind of putting out there at the moment about TB is massive, and the way that she can kind of reach such a wide audience with that is great. And I've got huge admiration for her and her ability, and I love kind of following what she does. So, yeah, love Abby Reader's her Facebook and Twitter and everything's great.
Yeah, really good answer. Yeah, Abby is a legend, isn't she? Okay. Emma, thank you so much for people listening. This is our second attempt at this. Thanks to my crappy broadband. You've been very patient and I do appreciate it. And thanks for taking the time to talk to us and sharing your experiences. Yeah, helping so many people in the farming community in Wales and beyond. And that is it's a really incredible thing. So please keep up the amazing work that you do.
Thank you very much. And thank you for allowing us to kind of come on and kind of get the message out there. It's fantastic. And I remember kind of listening to your podcast ages ago with Doug Avery, and I was like, that's kind of made it. When I've made it, I'm on there. So I feel like I've made it now. Adam Henson's done nothing. I'm on the Rock and Roll podcast. This is great.
Well, you can come back again.
Yeah, definitely. That'll get you everywhere.
All right, then. Thanks, Emma. And hopefully, we'll catch up with you
cheers.
Soon.
Thank you.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening. I hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.